Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Pretend this was Tuesday morning rather than Thursday morning, and the Iowa app debacle had never happened. Pretend that's the case, if you can, because the results are almost all in now, and the results of an election that people have been anticipating for a year should be the story at least as much as everything that's wrong with apps and caucuses and what states get to go first. And basically, Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg are about tied for first. They'll get about the same number of convention delegates when everything is counted up. Elizabeth Warren did okay. And the biggest story is probably that Joe Biden relatively tanked, coming in fourth. He knows it, and he admits it.
I am not going to sugarcoat it. We took a gut punch in Iowa. The whole process took a gut punch. But look, this isn't the first time in my life I've been knocked down.
Joe Biden yesterday. It's on to New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina now, where the competition within and between the more centrist and more progressive candidates is continuing. My next guest is looking for unity between the wings of the Democratic Party in the name of winning this November and in the name of the larger project of saving our country from the long-term fracturing we've been experiencing. It's the veteran Washington Post columnist and All Things Considered commentator E.J. Dion. He's got a new book called Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. E.J., always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's such a joy to be on your show. Thanks so much.
Let's begin on the news. What happened to Joe Biden in Iowa?
I think in some ways Pete Buttigieg happened to Joe Biden in Iowa. What's ironic about the result in Iowa is that if you look at the entrance poll of folks going in, Joe Biden did succeed in getting the voters focused on the issue that he wanted them to focus on, who can beat Donald Trump. Over 60% of caucus goers said that mattered more to them than a candidate's stand on issues. The problem for Joe Biden is he only got about a quarter of those voters. Buttigieg got at least as many, maybe more when it's all said and done. And Klobuchar also took a piece of that. And then, the rest went to Warren and Sanders. So that I think that Buttigieg's organization in the state, the energy he created by being a younger candidate, and the fact that he positioned himself ever so slightly to the left of Joe Biden. I have a column up today where I point out that Buttigieg and Biden split the moderates, but Buttigieg won those who called themselves somewhat liberal. That may prove to be the sweet spot in Democratic primaries. Of course, we can't leave out the fact that Bernie Sanders came in first in the popular vote, may finally, when all the votes are counted, just edge out Buttigieg in delegates. He's got a firm base in the Democratic Party. And what I wrote this book because I want to argue that the forces represented by Buttigieg, Biden, Klobuchar, and about half of the Warren constituency need to come to terms with the forces represented by Bernie and the other half of the Warren constituency. The first line of my book is, "Will progressives and moderates feud while the country burns?" And I am desperately afraid of that because I think there is a great opportunity here to create a new coalition. And we saw it come together in 2018.
South Carolina and Biden's support among older African-Americans there are supposed to be his firewall. And then on to Super Tuesday with so many racially diverse states, which should make Iowa a blip and nothing more. But the latest South Carolina poll I saw a few days ago had Biden down to 25% support, with Sanders on his tail now at 20%, just a 5-point gap after what had been a more than 20-point gap with Biden up in the 40s a little while ago. How do you see South Carolina at this point?
I think it is, you're 100% right, obviously, that Biden has to win that, or I think he's done as a candidate. And I think there is still very intense loyalty to Biden among older African-Americans. One of the fascinating things is everything, the fight between Biden and Bernie, if you just want to look at those two, is really in many ways a replay of what, if you're old enough, you can remember the fight against George McGovern and Hubert Humphrey. Biden in Iowa swept the over 65s, and that is a cross-racial coalition he has, Biden has among older voters. Bernie sweeps the under 30s. I think Biden
and that's increasingly, we should say, because sometimes it gets tagged as not this. That's increasingly a biracial, multiracial coalition, too, of
correct.
Younger voters for Bernie Sanders. Right.
Right. Yes, he does. He does very well among younger African-Americans, although African-American younger voters tend to be more pro-Biden than any other kind of young voter. I think what that means, and Biden knows it, and it's why he's casting himself as an underdog in New Hampshire, is that if he is wiped out in New Hampshire, if he runs fourth again or fifth, that could create real problems for him going into South Carolina. I mean, I guess the one thing you can say Biden has going for him is New Hampshire historically likes underdogs. Hillary Clinton came in there 13 points behind Barack Obama back in 2008 and surprised everybody, including, I should admit, me, by beating Obama in New Hampshire. That's what Joe Biden is praying for right now.
And one big difference with Buttigieg is that so far he has like zero black support. So how does someone go anywhere after February if that's still the case? Even though at the moment he's in the headlines for, oh, look, Pete Buttigieg is tied for first in Iowa.
That's right. That Buttigieg is, first of all, it's astonishing what Buttigieg has done already, even if he doesn't prevail in the end. A 38-year-old, he was 37 when he started, mayor of a city of 102,000 people, becoming central to our politics. That's an amazing thing. However, if he cannot win the trust of African-American voters, that hurts him in two ways. Obviously, it hurts him because African-Americans overall constitute about a quarter of the Democratic primary vote. But it also hurts him in terms of electability. Obviously, a Democrat needs substantial turnout from African-Americans, and Democrats are very focused on who can win. And a lot of white voters care a lot about African-American opinion. A lot of white, more liberal voters say if a candidate can't win the trust of African-Americans, this is a real problem. So I think that, yes, that is the big obstacle. And South Carolina will either be the place where Buttigieg shows he can overcome that, or it won't. And, it could be a breakthrough state for him or a Waterloo.
Do the results in Iowa help establish the premise of your book, Code Red, that there is a real competition between wings of the Democratic Party that they better start to reconcile?
Well, of course I think that, Brian. But I actually do. I mean, this is a case where I think the reality matches what I want the reality to be, although actually I would rather have a reality where there wasn't this feud. The core arguments of the book are that Donald Trump's presidency has created a national emergency, that the Republican Party has radicalized, and its capitulation to Trump, with the very honorable and admirable exception of Mitt Romney, the capitulation to Trump is a sign of that. But so is the Republican Party's shift to a really quite radical position on core issues. Just take, they want to repeal Obamacare, for example. The other argument I make, in the book, is that progressives and moderates have more in common than they want to realize. I model an argument you might have between a progressive and a moderate, and I argue that they need to listen to each other more. I think the progressives are right that there was too much capitulation to the broad Reagan economic consensus, that progressives were more timid than we need now. But the moderates are also right that the kind of change that progressives advocate often happens in our history step by step. I go back to a thinker that you will remember, Brian mm-hmm. Michael Harrington, who, by the mm-hmm. way, was a democratic socialist, mm-hmm. Who told us that what we needed to look for was visionary gradualism. And I always like that phrase because the visionary part is where progressives are right, that you need big plans over the long run to change the country. The moderates are right about gradualism because almost all the reforms we've ever achieved, including Social Security, civil rights, happened step by step. But eventually we got there. And then lastly, just as a practical political matter, I spent a lot of time at the beginning of the book on the 2018 elections, which really showed that progressives and moderates need each other to prevail. And that was a very successful effort to show that even moderates in the Democratic Party right now are far more progressive than, say, the Blue Dog Democrats were of the past, in the past. And so I am praying that this party and this broad movement that ultimately will include independents and even some stray Republicans who are sick of Trump, Mitt Romney Republicans, we can now call them, this coalition has to come together because Trump is a real threat given the way the Electoral College works.
And so when we come back from a break, I'll ask you more how they can do that, because the issues between the moderate wing and the progressive wing of the party are real. We'll also take some phone calls. People are calling in just knowing you're here. E.J. Dionne, Washington Post columnist, All Things Considered commentator. His new book is Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. 212-433-WNYC. If you want to speak to E.J. today, 212-433-9692. And after we talked about Biden tanking in Iowa, we're going to play a clip of him when we come back from the break, trying to save himself in New Hampshire by going after Bernie Sanders. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne and his new book, Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. I mentioned before the break, E.J., Biden still hopes to be the moderate standard bearer, not Buttigieg or Klobuchar or Bloomberg if he gets his way. And yesterday he campaigned in New Hampshire by going after Bernie Sanders and specifically the implication for Democrats winning or holding Congress, as Biden argues it here.
Senator Sanders is a nominee for the party. Every Democrat in America up and down the ballot, in blue states, red states, purple states, it's easy and easy districts and competitive ones. Every Democrat will have to carry the label Senator Sanders has chosen for himself. He calls him, and I don't criticize him, he calls himself a Democratic socialist. Well, we're already seeing what Donald Trump is going to do with that.
Biden in New Hampshire yesterday. E.J., how much do you agree with Biden as a political analyst that a Sanders nomination poses different challenges down ballot than a moderate wing candidate?
Well, a lot of moderate members of the House who got elected from moderate districts are worried about that. So I think it's a real worry for Democrats. I think that one of the tributes to Sanders in this election is that Hillary Clinton 4 years ago didn't really go after Sanders very much because she assumed it turned out correctly that she was going to win the nomination. The fact that Sanders is under this kind of attack is an indicator that an awful lot of Democrats think he can win this thing. In my book, I argue that Sanders and also Elizabeth Warren have opened up space in the political debate that moderates should welcome. Thanks to Medicare for All, it is now clear for all to see that Obamacare was a very moderate way to go forward. Free college puts on the agenda a very important issue. I think what the progressives need to recognize is that having opened up space in the debate, there are ways of moving forward that may not get to their goal all in one step. That's why Elizabeth Warren is a good example. She talked about Medicare for All, but came back to the idea that this wouldn't happen immediately and that we have to move urgently to cover everyone. The other example, by the way, I spend a lot of time with is the wealth tax, because I think Warren has done a great service. It is time to talk about taxing wealth. And even if you think her proposal isn't the way to do it, suddenly ideas like raising the capital gains tax or having a stiffer estate tax on very big fortunes, those are back in the conversation and they are more moderate positions now. So my hope is that the more aggressive candidates, more aggressive progressive reformers are going to shift the conversation in a way that's going to help both the center left and the left going forward.
Let's take some calls. Rachel in Rockaway, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Rachel, I love your neighborhood, by the way. I have a lot of family down there.
Oh, thank you. We love it, too. I just need to say I take issue with the framing of the traditional Democratic voter as a moderate. We are liberal Democrats who just don't espouse the extremely progressive and, I would say at this point, dangerous positions when we should be embracing the Democratic voter and trying to bring in Republicans who are scared of what Trump is doing. They're out there. And I think it's unfair to call what are people who are extremely liberal moderates. I think it's an unfair framing, and I think it hurts us. And I take issue with how you started the segment by stating that it's up to the moderates to accept the progressives, which, while often more vocal these days, are not the majority of the party.
EJ.
I really appreciate that question. First of all, I won't go into it now, but I go in the book, I talk at some length about the problem with the term moderate. And the caller is broadly right. At the beginning of the segment, you may have heard me say that the people who call themselves somewhat liberal were the largest group with the group that helped Buttigieg, and they were also the largest group. And so I use moderate to refer to the center left, partly because moderation is a word that speaks to realism. It's a word that speaks to a whole attitude toward public life, a propensity to seek conciliation and find balance. And there are a lot of liberals who are prepared to do that. That's how we got the New Deal. That's how we got the Fair Deal. So you're quite right. I identify myself as a liberal or a social democrat in my politics. So I'm very sympathetic to what you say. I'm using this conventional, and when I say that moderates need to come to terms with progressives, I'm not saying that moderates or liberals, as more moderate liberals, have to agree with everything that progressives say. I'm saying that if these two sides choose to see themselves as enemies rather than allies in moving the country forward, both sides are going to lose. If I can make one more point, there's a whole conversation about whether Democrats should choose between restoration or transformation. Do we just need to restore pre-Trump values, or do we need to transform the country? Obviously, we need both. We desperately want certain values that we upheld in the White House, in the presidency, what we expected from public officials before Trump came along. But if we don't transform the country, deal with some of the inequalities, some of the regional inequalities, some of the racial division and discrimination, we won't deal with the underlying causes that helped create Trump in the first place. And so I'm trying to fight against false choices on the broad center left, including the middle, but also the left. But I appreciate it. I take the caller as a friendly correction to what I was saying, because I don't think I was quite precise enough in trying to define what I'm arguing in the book. So thank you for the call.
And Rachel, thank you. Please call us again. One could argue that it's more the progressive wing of the party that has to reconcile with the moderates than that the moderates have to reconcile with the progressives, in that one of the things that happened in 2016 is that some of the progressives who voted for Sanders in the primaries stayed home and didn't think Hillary Clinton was a worthy enough candidate. I mean, that was just one of many factors that contributed to her loss. But in a way that that we don't know whether it would have happened if Sanders was the nominee, but it did happen in this direction, unless you think that's an exaggeration.
No, I think that each side, there is a lot of hostility at various moments between the left of the party and the sort of center left. I'll just use those terms for now, in deference to Rachel. There was a problem, I think, with some progressives who said, you know, Hillary's so bad, I'm not going to vote, or I'm going to vote third party. That caused a real problem. This turnout, the margins in the three critical states were very small. So that sentiment made a real difference. And I think it's always a mistake for people on the left to say, well, our center left allies aren't good enough. Better to let the other side take over. But moderates also have to recognize that progressive impatience with where the country is, the long-term rise of inequality, going back, depending on how you want to count it, to the mid-70s or 1980, is a real problem. And that what progressives are upset and angry about are legitimate things to be upset and angry about. One of the examples I use historically in the book of what I see as a functional relationship between the left and a governing sort of liberal establishment, if you will, was between Franklin Roosevelt and Sidney Hillman of the CIO. The old CIO, the labor movement, was putting pressure on Roosevelt from the left to move in a more progressive direction. And Roosevelt often welcomed that pressure. At the same time, they gave critical support to Roosevelt when he needed it facing against right-wing enemies. We need that kind of functional relationship between the left and, again, all these terms are vexed, but I'll call it a liberal establishment, if we're going to move forward.
On in Boulder, Colorado. You're on WNYC with E.J. Dion. Hi, On.
Hi, Brian. I wanted to say that the guest's plea for pragmatism is ironic, given that we just came out of the, or just concluded the impeachment trial, where the argument was that we would be judged by history, and therefore the Democratic Party couldn't afford to be pragmatic. They had to take a principled stance. And I think there's an underestimation of the extent to which progressive voters feel the same way about the Democratic Party, whether it's absolving Obama of his sins or sort of, in my view, contempt for brown bodies. I think there's come a point for a lot of progressive voters where it's not really a question of if I don't vote for the Democratic candidate, then the Republican candidate will win. At some point, you just have to sort of, for your own self-respect and dignity, say, I can't do this anymore.
EJ.
Thank you for that. I'd like to argue my book is not unprincipled. In fact, I lay out a series of very clear principles, including, by the way, on the politics of race, identity, and the need to be very tough in supporting equal rights and opposing racism, you know, fighting against racism, restoring voting rights, restoring civil rights. Secondly, on impeachment, I was one of those who wondered whether impeachment was a good idea early on, because I think that defeating Trump at the polls is, if Trump loses in an election overwhelmingly, that will send a very strong signal that the country wants to move in a new direction. I became a very strong supporter of impeachment when the Ukraine matter came out, because I thought that in the case of the Mueller report, Mueller himself was not willing to take the step you needed. I think in the end he was more timid than we hoped for to really call out exactly what Trump did. On the other hand, I thought that once we had the information on Ukraine, it was very clear that Trump had to be impeached. So if you read my column over the last several months, I have been an ardent supporter of this effort. And I think it made the point that the caller says it made.
Yes. To the caller's point, Nancy Pelosi decided, I guess, that she was going to run headlong into this polarizing certain defeat. Right, which is how it wound up, a polarizing certain defeat. because she felt she needed to for principle and for the sake of the future.
Right, exactly. And I think that we should juxtapose progressivism with pragmatism. All of our successful progressive leaders, both movement leaders and people we sent to the White House, have been pragmatic in the sense that they wanted to win the reforms they were fighting for. And if it took some compromise to take the first step forward so we could make the second step forward, they made it. That's not unprincipled. We should remember the word pragmatic, in a way, goes back to some of the most principled and progressive philosophers in our history, notably John Dewey, which I guess makes me a Dewey-eyed liberal.
One more call. Antonio in Bayside. Antonio, we have about 30 seconds for you. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to go with the underreported story that Steve Kornacki has just, it's on the MSNBC website, where he goes into the breaks down the Iowa caucuses, where it is at this moment, and explains it in a very coherent way, where what we're waiting for is the satellite caucus results, and those are, to explain it quickly, those allowed Iowa residents to
right, to vote in Paris,
right.
And
even if they weren't in Iowa.
Charlotte. So you're going to the math of the fact that Bernie, through those satellite caucus votes, may overtake Buttigieg for who actually finishes a slim first instead of a slim second, right?
Well, it's right now it's at 0.2%, and if you go by the numbers that are coming out of those areas, which is it's divided into four. Like if you divide Iowa, like 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Right. I know. And I don't have time to go, down that whole rabbit hole of that math. But I saw that story and I see it. But does it matter, Antonio, if Buttigieg gets, one more, because this isn't a winner-take-all state. They're going to get...
Is your point, sir, just so we can jump, that why in the heck did the party sit on returns that were going to put Bernie over the top? Is that the thrust of your comment?
Well, the thrust of my comment is, like, right now, Bernie Sanders is doing well in California, a state which is an amalgamation of the United States. It goes quite well. He's going to wipe out everyone in New Hampshire, and I feel that the Democratic Party is especially afraid. There was a story this morning about if the Democrats nominate Bernie Sanders, that would be an insane thing. That's crazy, because Bernie Sanders is just going for things that are logical. Every country on the planet has something like universal health care or something that they choose, outright. They're not going to choose like something that we have, which concedes worse results, worse outcomes. That's a fact.
And more expensive and more private sector. Antonio, thank you. Last word on all of it. 30 seconds, EJ.
Two things. What happened in Iowa is a catastrophe, and the fact that they counted in the way they did, and if Bernie goes ahead at the very end, I will totally understand why Bernie Sanders supporters said, "Party, what did you do?" I don't think it was a conspiracy. I think it was incompetence, and it's very unfortunate. The second point is, every country gets to universal coverage differently. I am passionately against this healthcare system and want to change it so everyone has decent, affordable care. You can go in a single payer direction, more Canadian or English. You can also go with a mixed system, more the Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, and other places. I don't think we should tear each other apart over exactly how we get there. The litmus test is we got to cover everybody, and that's what we have to talk about. And there are a lot of issues like that, free college, Green New Deal, the wealth tax, where I think if we sit down with each other on the broad progressive side, we can reach agreement on first steps, then second steps, and then third steps forward.
E.J. Dion, Washington Post columnist, All Things Considered commentator, and more. Is now the author of Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. EJ, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with 2 years left in the de Blasio administration, homelessness continues to be a key issue that the mayor can't seem to solve. With the end of the administration approaching and a new election cycle about to begin in the city, there have been some new proposals recently by some folks who may want to replace Mayor de Blasio. Controller Scott Stringer was on the show last week, many of you heard, talking about his new affordable housing plan. City Council Speaker Corey Johnson and some other council members are supporting a proposal with the support of former City Council Speaker Christine Quinn to increase the value of housing vouchers so people can get into stable housing off the street. Johnson seems to be running, and Quinn also might be running come next year. Former City Council Speaker Christine Quinn joins us now. She is currently the president and CEO of WIN, the largest provider of shelter and supportive housing for New York City homeless families. Welcome back to WNYC. It's been a long time. Good to see you.
It has. Good to see you, and thank you.
And why don't you tell people what you've been doing? What's your organization, WIN?
So WIN, Women in Need, we are the largest provider of shelter and permanent supportive housing to homeless families in New York City. 92% of those families are headed by women. And to put it into perspective for people, you know, we're at an all-time high in shelter. 70% of the people in shelter are families with children. We think it's singles because that's who we see. You can't have your child on the street. It's a crime. We need to understand this forgotten face, which is little ones.
Why are you getting behind this voucher program and coming out publicly for this particular thing?
Well, we house 10% of all the homeless families in the city of New York. So what we see is statistically significant. And I think we have to take the stories of our families and their experience and activate that into change. So what we see every day in our shelters is that the vouchers that the city gives people, when they then go out with our staff to rent an apartment, they can't find any. We have staff housing coordinators just dedicated to being our real estate agents. They can't find any. Why can't they find any? Because for a family of four, for a two-bedroom apartment, the city vouchers pay for a total rent, and you pay 30%, a total rent of $1,558. We did a study at WIN. There is no neighborhood in the city of New York where the asking median rent for a two-bedroom apartment is $1,558. Nowhere. So people, we believe on average, based on our data, are staying in shelter 2 to 3 months on average longer than need be because we can't find apartments. And then when we do, they're below standard, let's be honest.
And so the specific proposal is to add a specific dollar amount to the value of the voucher?
Yes. Our goal is to get the voucher up to 100% of fair market rent. That would take in the family, you know, of four that I was just talking to us, to about $2,000 for an apartment. Our study shows there are 8 to 12 neighborhoods in the city where the median asking rent, the rent, is about $2,000. That will get people into better apartments and out of shelter more quickly. And our goal needs to be to get people out of shelter and make sure they don't come back. So also having them be in a better apartment means they're less likely to come back. And I just want to make a point that I find fascinating. This year in the city's budget for their vouchers, they budget that only 20% of the money will be spent. So through their own admission, they have told us the present value doesn't work.
The vouchers aren't being spent because they can't find the landlords to take them?
Bingo. Exactly. Exactly. And they've now told us that, but yet the mayor says we can't afford to do this.
Well, as you may know, after you were on New York One on Thursday night last week on Inside City Hall,
yes.
You were asked, what would you say to the mayor about this?
And I answered.
You answered. You said, make forward movement on homelessness and support this legislation. And the next day, the mayor joined us for our weekly Ask the Mayor segment. I played him your clip and asked him to respond. And here's what he said back to you.
If anyone's laboring under the illusion that we can solve homelessness without federal support, let's have an honest conversation about that. We need an increase in the Section 8 program, which is the most, both in terms of the number of housing vouchers and the amount of dollars attached to them. There's a whole host of things the federal government could be doing that would help us address homelessness. So the city of New York is absolutely investing a huge amount of money to turn things around, and we're seeing some actual movement, and that's very, very important. I think there's a fallacy here to think that we have all the tools we need to solve this 40-year-old problem on our own.
Want to keep the conversation going?
Yeah. First of all, the Fed should do more. There's no question. There's no question, and the mayor himself has, to his credit, railed against Ben Carson, the secretary, for not doing enough. The mayor, by his own admission, just said we don't have enough tools. We don't have the right tools. Let me say a couple things. One, keep pounding Washington without a doubt. Keep pushing Albany without a doubt. But we have to raise the amount of these vouchers. We are the city of New York. These are New York City residents in shelter. The mayor cannot, no senior elected official can in this case turn away from this problem and say, let's hope the next administration gets it better. There are more children in shelter than there are seats in Madison Square Garden. As a senior elected in this city, the mayor or anybody else, you have to take that problem on head on. He has done good things, but it is galling, in my opinion, not to allocate this extra money and get people out. You know what? What happens when you're on your subway and you see a homeless person? I've done it too. You look away. We can't keep looking away. The problem only gets worse and children suffer.
Listeners, we can take a few phone calls for former New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, who is now the president and CEO of WIN, the largest provider of shelter and supportive housing for New York City's homeless families, and is supporting a city council bill to increase the value of vouchers for housing, as you've been hearing, for homeless families to a higher level that would make it easier for them to actually find landlords willing to take them. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We'll get to a few calls in just a minute. You know, one of the things that's broken out as a news story, even just in the last few days, is that last year domestic violence became the largest cause of homelessness in the city, according to certain measures, surpassing evictions. That's according to an October report by Comptroller Scott Stringer. You want to talk about the current systems in place, since you deal with women and children who are homeless in particular, to help survivors of domestic violence when they decide to leave their abusers or need to? Are you seeing an increase in that trend?
It is the drive this past year, the main driver into family shelter is domestic violence. 80% of the moms at WIN are domestic violence survivors, 80%. We are not a domestic violence shelter. We are not designated. We get no specific resources. We get private resources we raise, but no specific ones from the government around domestic violence. It's like we've built this shelter system it's like building a hospital to deal with the current crisis of a disease, and then not putting any doctors in that hospital who can have the skills to solve it. That's what's happening. 80% and no government funds to support it. And we're not even a DV shelter. And I just want to thank Speaker Johnson, going back to the vouchers for a second, because in his report last week around homelessness proposals and some excellent proposals, he came out in support of raising the voucher to 100% of fair market rate. We are so grateful. And Steve Levin, the chair of the General Welfare Committee, has been the champion of this bill. And the bill has 39 sponsors, so it is veto proof.
There's a question I was going to ask you about Mayor Bloomberg's contribution to this, but we have a caller who wants to do it too. So we designate Amir in Queens, partnering journalist in this interview. Amir, thank you for calling.
Hi, Amir. Thank you.
Hi, how are you? Speaker Quinn, how's everything?
I'm good. How you doing?
Very good. So I agree 100%. I think we need to raise the homeless vouchers program. I think that we should be able to pay to have everybody who's living in shelter permanently housed in this city. But I can't help but think that when you were Speaker of City Council under Bloomberg, the city saw the highest rate of we saw so much
increase
inequality in this city. We saw so much, the rents go up astronomical. We saw the continuation of building unaffordable housing and luxury housing. I just can't help but think, why now are you coming out and saying that you're going to come and help people without housing, when under Bloomberg, for the three terms that he had in which you helped gave him, we saw the most economically inequality in this city that we've ever seen.
Amir, I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to add another specific point, which is that Mayor de Blasio, when he's on the show and we talk about homelessness, he always refers back to Mayor Bloomberg ending the Advantage program, as it was called, that that the current mayor considers a great contributor to the spike in homelessness that has taken place since. Do you disagree?
No. So let me say a couple things. Amir, I'm glad you asked the question, because there have been for a long time, a lot of fights in City Hall around homelessness. It never got the media attention it should have. So a lot of New Yorkers don't know what we did around homelessness when I was Speaker. So let me say a couple things. Advantage, which Brian references, is the city voucher when Mike Bloomberg was mayor. He cut that voucher out, and it sent everyone, basically, I'm slightly exaggerating, but basically everyone who had the voucher pulled the rug out from under them. They went back to shelter. Every year after that happened, we in the city council allocated, put forth to allocate funds to put Advantage back in, and the mayor said he would not spend it. That's not the only problem with the mayor's record on homelessness. When I was Speaker of the City Council, they tried to change the rules to let fewer homeless men into shelter. We in the City Council, my colleagues and I, took him to court and we beat him. And that prevented throwing single homeless men out the door of intake. It's a problem that the Bloomberg administration, in my opinion, was not good on. And we really responded in the council, and he's going to have to deal with that on the trail, obviously, the new trail.
Do you have any opinion about which presidential candidate has the best homelessness or housing in general plan?
You know, I don't yet. I have not reviewed them all. I'm not sure they all have some. We did reach out to all of the Democratic candidates. To be fair, it was before Bloomberg entered the race, and offered our assistance to help them develop a plan around family homelessness. And I will say the O'Rourke campaign very quickly scheduled a number of calls with us about it.
Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah. Distant memory.
It's funny because the ones that we've talked about on the show with specific housing programs are all out. Beto O'Rourke, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, and the former HUD secretary, Castro.
Right.
They're the ones who are gone.
They called us too. I think Castro called us too. I want to be clear about that.
Let's take another phone call. Hawken in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with former City Council Speaker Christine Quinn. Hi, Hawken.
Yes, hi. Just a question. I'm not saying we shouldn't do the vouchers because it's an emergency and all that, but isn't it one of the mechanisms that continue pushing rents up? And why doesn't the city have a program where at least they try to build some apartments? Because that would actually lower the rents for everybody.
Thank you for the question, Hogan. Let me start with the second part for a second. We can't voucher our way out of this problem. And we can't build our way out of this problem. We need to do both. But you're 100% right that we need to build new housing. Some of it should be supportive with services, others without services, not supportive housing. That we need to build that and make sure the rents in a significant portion of those apartments are ones homeless people can afford. So the first rent iteration of Mayor Bloomberg's affordable housing plan didn't have one apartment that somebody exiting a WIN shelter could afford. Now, it wasn't designed to be a homeless housing plan, but we need a plan that is specific on that and that has rents that low. I completely agree with you. There has been this kind of, in a way, like right-wing argument out there. I'm not saying you're right-wing, Hawken. I'm sure you're not. Argument that raising vouchers will raise overall rents.
This comes up in the college tuition aid conversation too. There are, yes, generally fiscal conservatives who say, wait, the colleges aren't stupid. They know how much the families can actually pay out of pocket. So when you add tuition assistance on top of that, they're just going to push up tuition by that much.
Right. Right. And so it's exactly right. And there has been an argument around Section 8, the federal vouchers. And many studies have been done that debunk that theory completely. But also, you just think about it. There are 60,000 homeless folks now. Some are going to go to supportive. Some are going to go to other settings. And then hopefully a lot are going to go into affordable free market apartments, so to speak. Mathematically, that's not going to change the entire rental market in the city of New York. Beyond being debunked in a methodological, you know what I'm trying to say, it also just doesn't make sense.
I do see that last week Michael Bloomberg released a national housing proposal that he says would make housing more affordable in general and tackle homelessness in particular. It would guarantee rental assistance for extremely low-income Americans, however that's defined, and cut homelessness in half, he predicts, by 2025 by doubling federal funding to fight it from the current $3 billion to $6 billion. Have you seen the details enough to have a comment?
I just got the plan Friday morning and don't have enough time with it yet to have a comment. I mean, it seems like some of it just on the top lines are not dissimilar from what we've long been pushing into.
Because it's also a voucher plan. And again, I haven't read into it, but I've just seen, you know, headlines of a press report that it does call for guaranteeing housing vouchers for all Americans at or below 30% of their area's median income.
Yeah. So, I mean, I haven't seen all the details yet, but the top lines kind of make you go, huh? Sounds like something we've pushed him on before. So if when I read the details, that's true, then thank you for listening, finally.
Sally in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have one question about Wynn that you work with, and also in general, because I see a problem. You know, I agree with you that more money should be given because the market rent is so high, but I live near a homeless shelter, and I'm wondering if Wynn or anybody else is doing anything to help with career counseling for these people.
Yes,
because I walk out early in the morning and late at night, and I have to say it really degrades the neighborhood to have people on the corner drinking and smoking all day and all night, even in the wintertime. So that's where, in addition to giving somebody an apartment they can afford, we need to help these people get jobs.
Yeah, let me say, first of all, we'll set aside the degrades the neighborhood comment for the moment, but clearly I want to just say for the record, I don't agree with that. You don't know that those people are homeless. A lot of people hang around outside. You know, that's not illegal. So I just feel as someone who works with homeless people on the record, I just have to say that. That said, Sally, you hit the nail on the head. The best indicator that someone will not return to shelter is a good job. 51% of the women in Wynn shelters are working and they can't pay the rent.
Wow.
So you're right. We at Wynn have built up a one-of-its-kind income-building program, which includes trainings from Google, the Francine LaFrac Foundation, major funding from PepsiCo. And our job isn't just, we don't see our job as, here's how you write a resume, here's a new suit. We do all that. But it's really tracking training to place people in jobs and industries where there are vacancies. I just rattled off a lot of private funders. Not every shelter has this. We raise most of the money privately. Sally, you're right. This should become a requirement and built into the contracts the shelters have with the city of New York. I agree with you.
We only have about 2.5 minutes before we go to today's live impeachment trial coverage, where they'll be doing in closing arguments, and I want to get in two more things. The last thing will be to ask you the obligatory question of if you're considering running for mayor. But first, one more detail of this, because the caller brings up shelters and also hotels as part of his 2017 Turning the Tide on Homelessness plan. Mayor de Blasio announced that the city would end the use of commercial hotels for New Yorkers experiencing homelessness by 2023. But City Limits reports now that as of last month, there were over 11,000 people living in hotels. So how do you see an end to this system in 3 years' time?
So let me say, I applaud the mayor for putting out Turning the Tides. It called for building 90 more shelters, 40% for families, the first time a family set aside during an election year. I applaud the mayor for that. Look, a night in shelter costs $201. A night in a hotel with no services or limited services costs $270. Our vouchers add a month, 37 more. 270 a night, 201 a night, 37 a month. The raising the vouchers is a key element to getting out of shelters, which are not safe, most of them, and don't have services. If people get out of shelter earlier, we need less hotels.
15 seconds.
Okay.
Are you putting this out there right now? It's a city council proposal. We could have members of city council talking about this, but you really want to be out there talking about this. Are you considering a run for mayor?
I want to be out there every day talking about this because every day I'm working with homeless women and their children, and they're telling me how much longer they're staying in shelter they want a home.
You're not ruling it out.
Right now I'm running win, and come hell or high water, I'm getting the vouchers raised to fair market rent 100%.
Former New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, working in the homelessness sector, as she's been describing. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. In the age of Trump, in the age of Putin, in the age of Modi and Erdogan and Bolsonaro, and I could go on, what is the future of democracy? The New Yorker magazine is asking that question with a series of articles, and there was a great one in last week's edition by historian and New Yorker staff writer Jill Lepore. Some of you may remember she was here recently for her one-volume U.S. history called These Truths, A History of the United States. She's also a history professor at Harvard. And now Jill Lepore is back with us to talk about some eerie parallels between the 1930s and today, parallels that might actually give us hope and a path to follow, not just make us shake our heads. And part of the story is about the potential of radio to enhance democracy. Jill, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Your story really starts in World War I, which the president at the time, Woodrow Wilson, called the war to make the world safe for democracy. And in the short run, it did.
Yeah, it actually did. I mean, I think it's important to remember, just to sort of see where we are in the chronology of history. You know, European nations had been ruled by monarchs for centuries. And in the decades before the First World War, constitutional republics were emerging and the age of monarchy was coming to an end. And the Ottoman and Austrian empires were being destroyed and dismantled during the First World War. And what Wilson was promising was a new dawn for democracy, that modernity would involve the diffusion of democracy around the world, that the end of authoritarian rule was on the horizon.
So World War I ended in 1919, but by 1922, Mussolini was marching on Rome. Fascism and communism were toppling new democracies that had only recently replaced old monarchies, as you remind us in your piece. Is there a, you know, short radio interview version of why these new democracies were so susceptible so quickly?
Well, partly it had to do with just the fragility of very young democracies. It's kind of like a very high infant mortality rate for democracies, because if the institutions of self-government aren't part of the political culture and the civic culture, it can take a while for them to really develop, as you know, we now know, I think, but that was kind of a surprise to a lot of people in the 1920s.
Much of your article is about the question of would democracy even survive at that time, and that question about the future of democracy, the question itself became ubiquitous in this country, in the media and in public discourse in the 1930s. Can you give us a sense of that ubiquity?
Well, it is really eerily similar to now. I mean, if you go into a bookstore, you'll see all kinds of books called, you know, How Democracy Ends, Why Democracies Die. Those same titles are all over magazines and in bookstores in the 1930s. And even, you know, the New York The New Yorker's running this series on the future of democracy. The New Republic in the 1930s ran a series on the future of democracy. People were really wondering whether this form of government, which was newer then, would endure, especially in the 1930s because of the tremendous suffering of the Great Depression.
Was there doubt in the United States about the value of democracy versus something else to solve the problems of the Depression?
I think there was a sense that the suffering was so severe and the reforms needed, especially the reform of the banking system, which you recall when FDR took office, the very first thing he did was shut the banks down. The idea was that our system of government, which distributes power across the three branches of government, couldn't act quickly enough, didn't have a consolidated power in order to make the changes as fast as they needed to be made to save the economy. There was a real concern that FDR, I think a fairly widespread concern, that FDR would have to take on essentially dictatorial powers in order to do what needed to be done.
And I've read that FDR's New Deal, because it was just enough socialism, saved democracy and saved capitalism, because otherwise the American people may have opted for something like Russia had opted for, too. How much is that your take?
I think there's a sense, you know, the best scholarship on the New Deal really considers how contemporaries regarded FDR's challenge and the challenge of Congress as steering some kind of a middle path between a fully state-run economy, which would take us, you know, to socialism and communism, or the continuation of really laissez-faire business wins, market-driven economy, which had been Hoover's approach. Hoover, of course, was a businessman. That is FDR's predecessor. FDR had to try to find a way to essentially invent something new, a kind of hybrid between those two extremes. And that's what the New Deal was.
You even cite a W.E.B. Du Bois column headlined, "Do We Negroes Believe in Democracy?" unquote. And given that the context for Du Bois was obviously the struggle for basic rights and white America continuing to resist, was he considering different forms of government that might be better at providing equality under the law?
I think that what writers like Du Bois were doing, a lot of African-American writers, a lot of women political writers as well, I talk about Mary Ritter Beard, the famous historian, what they were trying to do was use this crisis as an opportunity to explain that the democracy hadn't been working before either, that a democracy that doesn't enfranchise vast percentages of its citizens isn't really a democracy in the first place, that it was an opportunity to think carefully about the problems of American democracy, not just the problems of the authority of the president to intervene in an economic crisis, but the bigger structural problems of participation and political equality.
Listeners, my guest is New Yorker staff writer, Harvard historian, and author of These Truths, A History of the United States, Jill Lepore. And she has an article in The New Yorker that's part of their new series on the future of democracy, comparing the questions we're asking about democracy today to those that were being asked in the 1930s. Anyone have a question for Jill Lepore or a story from your parents or your grandparents or anyone else? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I want to ask you about one little reference in your article and a parallel that I saw with something that came up on the show last week. You refer to a moment in a political debate on the radio in the 30s when a guy in the audience shouted, "You are a liar," at one of the debaters, and the moderator calmly said, "We don't allow that," and asked him to leave. And it reminded me that just last week, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman was here, and he mentioned how the rules for his column at the Times have evolved since he started writing it in the year 2000. Listen to this story.
2000 was really a radicalizing year for me because I was my first year at the New York Times, and there was the candidate of a major presidential party lying through his teeth about his tax plans, about his Social Security plans, and nobody was willing to say that. I was actually at the time forbidden from using the word lie in the New York Times, so I think times have changed a bit now.
I was forbidden from using the word lie in the New York Times. That was writing, of course, about George W. Bush as a candidate in 2000, and he said the times have changed now. And then when I read your article over the weekend, I thought, wow, is there any kind of historical through line about our discourse, you know, that means anything from your 1930s radio debate moment to the Times gradually allowing its columnists to call people liars in the 20th century to the culture of distrust and truth isn't truth that we're immersed in now?
There is absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a line. It's more of a big sprawling mess. But there are really changing standards, maybe for the radio, but also for the newspaper. If you, I mean, there's raucous political conversations on the radio in the 1930s, in the 1940s less so during wartime. Right? There's a whole kind of propaganda operation during wartime. But what happens in the 1950s really does significantly change journalism. When leading newspapers, this actually begins really with the Times, begin to suggest that the way that they've been reporting political news, which is essentially kind of stenographer-like, right? Like they're just sort of, here's what the White House said today. It'd be on the front page in the New York Times. And then there, you know, there'd be some opinion pieces that might sort of be delicately critical. But during the age of McCarthy and in the aftermath, you know, of Stalinism, the New York Times decided that it would change its approach, that it launched by the end of the 1950s an entirely new kind of newspaper piece that had, and they still do this, they have a kind of little subhead that says news analysis. And it's the birth by the end of the 1950s of adversarial journalism. And it's that adversarial journalism that makes possible the deep critical criticism of the Vietnam War, the reporting that Times, reporters for the Times and the Post, Washington Post do in the 1960s of Vietnam, because the tone of journalism has changed. It's possible. There's this kind of new category of analyzing the news rather than simply reporting what the White House has said or what happened in Congress that day. So when a similar transformation has happened in the age of Trump, right, it's not unlike the age of McCarthy, which is to say that editorial boards looking at what they're facing in terms of the misinformation coming out, you know, think about Edward R. Murrow in the See It Now broadcast about McCarthy in 1954. That took a lot for CBS News to be willing to actually say McCarthy is lying, right? But it really changed television journalism. The same has happened in the age of Trump.
By the way, a correction. I think I said World War II and World War I ended in 1919. Of course, if it was November 11th, 1918. For some reason, I was thinking this past November 11th was a big anniversary, but of course it was the year before. So let's take a phone call for Jill Lepore. Edward in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Edward.
Hi, Brian. I love your show, by the way.
Thank you.
Very informative. You're a smart guy. I appreciate that.
Thank you, sir.
Anyway, I could not. Democracy seems to be very selective or very limited a lot of times to the own people, to the own constituents of that nation's democracy. For instance, you know, the British in India, they didn't, there was no democracy in India for the Indian people that they colonized, or the you know, or for the Angolans in Africa that Portugal colonized, or the Ottomans in Palestine, or what Israelis are doing now with the Palestinians. There may be the only democracy in the Middle East, but not for the Palestinians. So it's limited. So, you know, a democracy is supposed to be, in my opinion, something that you believe in and something that is adhered to no matter where you are.
Like for your own, is what you're saying, right? For your own, people value democracy, not for others.
It's a democracy for your own, but not for anybody else.
Yeah.
So it's hypocritical and, you know, it's misleading to call ourselves a democracy when we go other places and colonize them or take power and those people don't have the same rights or benefits as, you know, our own constituents.
Edward, thank you so much for that call. And, you know, Jill, I was thinking of something similar reading your article, that one of the paradoxes of today, I think, is that voters in democracies are electing authoritarian or anti-democratic leaders, Bolsonaro and Modi and Trump, if he belongs in that category. And it always seems to come with hatred for minorities in the same societies. Obviously in Nazi Germany at the most extreme level, but majoritarian grievance politics in places like Hindu nationalism in India, expressions like that, and white and Christian nationalism here, et cetera. So not only, as Edward points out, when a country colonizes another country, but even domestically, this questioning of democracy seems to come with hatred toward domestic minorities.
Yeah, well, I think one way you can actually think about American democracy is that we can't, you know, to Edward's point, I think historically we can't really talk about American democracy until after 1965 and the Voting Rights Act, right? I mean, before 1965, the wide-scale disenfranchisement of American citizens is more than a taint on the democracy. It's just, in a deep way, means that it's not a democratic culture. And, one way that's, I think, some historians think about the course of American history is that our colonies are internal to the nation, right? Like, it's not like the British Empire denying voting rights to Indians. It's more the American government denying voting rights to African Americans within the nation's borders. So then you can think about the post-1965 American polity, and that is the age of polarization, right? Our the phenomenon of political polarization that plagues us today, when you track it quantitatively by the measures that political scientists use, really begins around 68, sometime between 68 and 72. So it is harder. A democracy is harder, requires more thinking, requires more capacity for understanding common interests across difference in the kind of sprawling nation and diverse political community that we have in the United States.
And do you think about the fact that voters are voluntarily electing authoritarian, unless we conclude that all these elections are stolen? People chose Bolsonaro, people chose Modi, people chose Putin even. And again, Trump, if he belongs in that category.
Yeah, no, that is often how authoritarians come to power. And it's also very convenient for people who come to power that way to then talk about their authoritarian rule as fundamentally democratic. I mean, Hitler always said that Germany was a beautiful democracy, and Mussolini said that Italy and Germany were the best democracies in the history of the world, which led the U.S. columnist Dorothy Parker to say, if they're going to use the word democracy, I think we maybe need another word.
We'll continue in a minute with historian Jill Lepore on the future of democracy and the parallels between the conversation we're having about that today in this country and around the world, and the conversations and movements that were taking place in the 1930s. We'll take more of your calls, and we'll also talk about why radio becomes one of the heroes of Jill's 1930s narrative after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Harvard historian and New Yorker staff writer Jill Lepore, who has an article in The New Yorker about the future of democracy and the comparisons with the 1930s in the anxiety about democracy on the wane with today. So it turns out radio in the 1930s is one of the heroes of your story. Why radio?
Well, because radio in the United States makes a commitment to fostering this conversation. I mean, in the way that, you know, this new New Yorker series on the future of democracy is attempting to kind of get people to look at, think about, face squarely, have conversations like this conversation about the future of democracy, radio really committed itself in the 1930s to doing that. And partly, I think it was because radio had been quite instrumental in Europe to the rise of dictators. Because it was possible, I mean, you know, Hitler's minister of propaganda required every German to have a radio in their house. And from his desk, you know, Goebbels could turn on a switch and would just tell people what to believe. That radio has all kinds of inherent, as a technology, dangers because it's the sort of invasive form of communication. It's very intimate. And in the U.S., because of the Federal Radio Act of 1927 and later the Federal Communications Act in 1934, broadcasters understood that as a danger and committed to a set of obligations to the public to do public interest programming, to have equal time for different points of view. And so, you know, radio networks broadcast programs that were designed to get people to disagree with one another and kind of have it out, almost the way that you could sort of inoculate people against the temptations of fascism or of communism by having them see how democracy actually works, how trying to kind of rekindle the tradition of conversation and argument. I mean, you could think about that. One of the reasons for this eerie similarity is the internet, which people thought, you know, if you remember in the late 90s, was going to be such a democratizing technology, mm-hmm. but turns out to be quite the reverse, is because it's so unregulated, right? But it nevertheless still has the potential to steer us towards new forms of democratic expression.
And I think we have a question about this from Rufus in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC with Jill Lepore. Rufus, hi.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Professor, I haven't read your op-ed yet, but I am curious to hear you say a few words, if you wouldn't mind, about the difference between radio back in the 30s and today, and also maybe a distinction between radio and television. Of course, there wasn't television in the 30s. It seems as though television is being used equally to misinform, and so how can we hope that media in general can play the role of any kind of savior of democracy when we see, you know, what we see in the opposite direction? So,
thank you. Great question. Thank you, Jill.
Yeah, thanks, Rufus. Well, actually, there's a really interesting book I bet you'd enjoy called Post-Broadcast Democracy by a political scientist from Princeton named Marcus Pryor, and what he looks at is the era of network broadcast media that is starting with radio in the late 20s through the mid 1970s, where yes, as you say, television is different, but it's really the question that it's the network broadcast system where there are basically three networks, and they're broadcasting news at the dinner hour. And in that era, American politics is actually relatively stable, and polarization is quite low. And what Pryor is able to demonstrate is there's a relationship between the decline of the end of the broadcast era, and, you know, so I think 1977 is the very beginning of cable television and the remote control, and then comes the dinner hour, and you could listen to the news, but now suddenly you could watch reruns of Gilligan's Island. There are 200 stations. Mm-hmm. You could watch whatever you want, and then there's the 24-hour cable news stations as well, which his argument is that those are an engine of our polarization because the regulated broadcast network system had a set of obligations to the public. It had the equal time provisions and the fairness doctrine that are part of the FCC, which through extensive lobbying were not part of the cable system. So there is actually a real moderating influence that broadcast media play in the middle decades of the 20th century. Radio in the 30s is kind of experimenting with that and exploring the limits of it. You know, as Brian said, the story of this show called America's Town Meeting of the Air, where there'd be these big debates held on a stage, and they'd be broadcast on the radio, but listeners could hold their own debates at home, but there was a big audience and people would ask questions. But if you behaved in a certain way, you'd be kicked out. It was a very moderated kind of conversation.
Do you think there's something lost, though, with not that kind of moderated conversation? I mean, it's the kind of thing that we do, and, you know, obviously I think is extremely important and valuable. But the three networks era, I think a lot of people on the right were dissatisfied with it because they saw a liberal bias. And I think a lot of people on the left were dissatisfied with it because they saw an establishment bias. And a lot of voices were locked out. And maybe it was just the papering over of polarization that wasn't allowed to flourish. I'm just curious how you look at the three networks era.
I think there is a lot of criticism, actually, and I would suggest it's both from the left and the right. On the right, it's the view that what we would call conservative views had no place on the radio or on television. Because in fact, if you think about that era, Republicans won the White House a lot more often than Democrats. It's not a party position. It's liberals versus conservatives, mm-hmm. which, remember, the parties hadn't aligned in those ways in those years. So it's actually the conservative critique of the broadcast era is that it supported moderation and politically moderate positions, and therefore silenced conservatives. And the left critique of the broadcast era is that it suppressed positions on the left, that it really was a fundamentally liberal, lowercase l, liberal medium. I think there's some I think there's some argument for both of those critiques, but I don't think that means we shouldn't learn from what was offered by those mediums.
By the way, did the place of radio and the government-funded, conversations about democracy that brought people into big and little rooms to hear the radio debates and participate in conversations with each other, and that whole very consciously directed exercise, did it differ from media in Europe in a way in the 30s that helped save democracy when it was under pressure here but left them more vulnerable?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I guess I would think about what the BBC was up to in the 1930s. And I think what the BBC was doing was fairly similar to what American broadcasters were doing. And I think American broadcasters were really influenced by that. But there's also more concern in Europe than there is in the U.S. just because of the proximity to Germany and, to Germany and broadcasters in particular with what was called for the very first time in the 1930s fake news. The British called Nazi broadcasts in the English language fake news because they were. I mean, the Nazis would broadcast English language news that was just all lies. It was about Nazi victories that never happened. It was about deserters, numbers of British deserters that were just made up. And the same thing was done across the Atlantic with shortwave radio broadcast into North America and also into South America. But it was much less of a – it just was harder to reach Americans because not everybody's got shortwave radio and is listening to these Nazi broadcasts. There was a lot of counter-programming by the BBC that was addressing a different concern.
Edward in Yonkers. You're on WNYC with Jill Lepore. Hi, Edward.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me. I've been teaching history, American history and world history and civics and government and all that stuff for some time now. And I got to tell you, when I was teaching the 1920s and 1930s, putting the radio on was important. I would set the stage in the classroom and have the kids listen, especially to FDR's fireside chat. And sometimes I would have them just sit there and just listen and then read what he wrote and then respond. And that was so wonderful. But now I hear the kids in class, and I get upset because they're listening to so many negative things about democracy and our country, and it bothers me so much, and it hurts. I'm a grandson of immigrants. My father was a World War II veteran. And I tell them this, and I try to make it personal to them. And, some of them get it. Some of them just don't want to. It's like they want that one strong man. It's like they're longing for the days of that dictator. And I don't want that. I want to knock that right out of their heads. Give me some help here.
History professor, help this history teacher.
Yeah, no, I totally hear you about that. I mean, one of the things that is so powerful, and I hope it still works as an exercise with your students because it's great to have them listen, is to think about how extraordinary it was in that era when, very few people are connected to other people. It's still a largely rural population in the 1930s. And the radio was the thing that connected people to a national culture for the very first time, and it's in the intimacy of your house. And what it did, what Americans came to understand was that they were kind of all in it together. Now, granted, there are huge divisions, and I don't mean to set those aside. But what Americans, all kinds of Americans, were suffering in the 1930s, and what they heard were one another's voices on the radio, largely talking about their suffering, a kind of, like NPR StoryCorps thing, every minute of every day. And so there was a sense of the dignity of ordinary people confronting really harsh living conditions in very different parts of the country. And so even when FDR gave his radio chats or his fireside chats, you can hear it in his voice. I mean, Eleanor Roosevelt always said that his voice changed after he was infected with polio and lost the use of his legs. that he suffered. I mean, he was this aristocrat, but and he's an incredibly wealthy guy. But you could hear in his almost sort of like, to say it's a Bill Clinton kind of I feel your pain thing maybe trivializes it. But FDR communicated with his voice that he too understood pain and want and need, and he was there with you. And that is a completely different – I mean, think about that voice against the Donald Trump's Twitter feed. It's not about, I understand that we're all having a hard time, things are difficult, let me tell you what I'm trying to do to help. Even if you are a Trump supporter, there's no way you can describe the tone of his Twitter feed as anything similar to that. So you wonder, where is that in our culture? It certainly doesn't seem to me to be abundantly available online.
So to Edward's cry for help as a teacher, we should probably mention that you also cite librarians and school teachers as heroes of democracy in the 1930s.
And they're still heroes of democracy today. I mean, I go into, you know, K through 12 classrooms and visit with people teaching history lessons, and there's incredible. I mean, I understand it can be awfully discouraging because of students' own discouragement. But I think we have this weird kind of fashionable radical pessimism that I think can be countered. And I'm sure, Edward, actually, that you do counter it a lot by being willing to display your own commitments and your own sense of obligation to self-government and its preciousness, that being willing to express your own enthusiasm, being willing to stand up for something, to stand up for the idea that courage matters, that there is ingenuity, that there is hope, it makes a real difference. You don't see it immediately because, you know, young people don't have the permission to be like, oh, really? I'm totally down with that. That's not the reaction you're going to get.
So let's end on that, because we are living in an age of pessimism. With your historical perspective, do you think it's too much?
I actually think there are all kinds of strengths in the United States, and obviously I'm talking only about the United States as an American historian, that we can see manifest every day if we only look for them. And I think it's worth thinking about, Brian, and not to seem to be making idle flattery, but this kind of radio show is actually a continuation from the 1930s tradition of civic discourse. And you know that it makes a difference.
Jill Lepore, Harvard historian, author of These Truths, A History of the United States, and a New Yorker staff writer. And her article in, I guess, last week's edition, technically the February 3rd edition, is a comparison of the threats to democracy in the 1930s and those today. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.